Welcome, listeners, to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sound and culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
Bonjour, my name is Marcella. I am Anishinaabe, or Ojibwe, and on this recording of Finding Lost Sounds for the Sounding Out podcast series, I'm talking with Dr. Candice Gala and Dr. Nancy Marie Myflo. My recording with these Indigenous scholars works in some ways as micro-lectures in sound, or lectures in silence and cultural performance. But in our talking, we're engaging with silence as a tool and really thinking critically about indigeneity through sound. What comes from the insightful work of Candice and Nancy are critical looks at Indigenous creative practices as important intellectual systems. I open the conversation with Nancy Myflo, whose work on sound moves beyond the conventional interpretations of silence as lacking in agency, to consider how silence may productively be mobilized in an Indigenous knowledge systems approach. I then welcome back to the podcast Candice Gala, who engages in our conversation that centers on sound from a critical Indigenous framework with hula and Hawaiian history. With Candice, we gain a deeper understanding of cultural performance, the importance of sound and cultural knowledge within the hula, and importantly, how Indigenous languages work through performative arts. We have two topics that might seem to not fit, or to be better off as two separate conversations. But what we find is that they intersect in many interesting ways. So I'm going to cut now to allow them to introduce themselves. And go ahead if you want to introduce yourself first, Candice, and then I'll ask Nancy to introduce herself, and then we can get right into our conversation.
Aloha mai kako, o vau o Candice Kalaimamo o Vahine Kapu Gala. No Hawaii mai au. Hello, my name is Candice Kalaimamo o Vahine Kapu Gala, and I am from the island of Hawaii. I'm a professor at the University of British Columbia in the Faculty of Education, in the Department of Language and Literacy Education. And my area of specialty is in Indigenous language revitalization, education, and multimedia technology.
Thanks, Candice.
Good morning, Marcella. Thanks for having me. I am Nancy Marie Myflo, and I am an associate professor of art history and visual arts at Occidental College in Los Angeles, and I'm also chair of American Indian Studies at the Autry Museum of the American West. And my tribal affiliation is Chiricahua Apache from Apache, Oklahoma, where my family is. I'm really passionate about my cultural knowledge base there. And also, I'm passionate about being an educator. I really enjoy the work that I've been doing in tribal colleges, in community colleges, liberal arts colleges, big universities. I've been teaching for about 30 years. And it turns out that I come from about six generations of educators on my mom's side. I just enjoy that. I enjoy the conversations that are enabled within the classroom. And that's what I've devoted myself to. My world is also shaped by the contemporary Indigenous arts world, whether that be performance or film or photography. And I think that the Institute of American Indian Arts has been a real influencing factor in my professional career and in my life as well. So I give a big shout out to the tribal college system.
Good. Well, thank you both for being on today. And let's get started. If you're thinking about silence and films, I wonder if there was sort of like geographical kind of like references or spaces for that. So do you see like films coming out of Oklahoma, say, to be particularly using sound, and then films coming out of Hawaii or the Pacific are very loud, for lack of a better word? Like, are there different regions that tend to use sound in different ways?
you know, that would be kind of my first go, is to try to put parameters or just a reference frame around my argument. And I think that when you generalize about Indigenous studies, just in a general fashion, it's almost it's too broad of a frame. And I always try to qualify our work. I mean, there is such a field as American Indian studies, Native American studies, Indigenous studies. We've framed that, so we know that that exists. Collectively, we've created that, so it does exist. And then how we define that frame really depends upon our own practice. When I was getting training in cultural anthropology, I remember that my professors would always say that I could not generalize at all, ever, about something that was American Indian art, for example, because I had to be specific to a cultural or a cultural region. And I saw that as like incredibly inhibiting and actually not even accurate, because I was coming out of the frame of primarily urban Indian situations or multi-tribal situations, whether it's Oklahoma or New Mexico or even up there in Vancouver, or what I would witness around the National Museum of the American Indian and when it was starting to become a real institution, because those were multi-tribal frames for me. And it totally made sense. It's just like right now with the Dakota Access Pipeline, I've been really bringing that into the classroom and teaching with that, whether it's about media representations or the Luis Rael thing about the artist will, you know, after 100 years, be the ones that lead the political protest. And what bothers me about the media is they keep referencing that this is the largest gathering of tribes. And some will say, like, in 100 years, and some will say in decades, and the largest gathering. And it's, to me, it's reminiscent of, like, oh, my gosh, the Indian Wars, you know, they're all coming together. Oh, my gosh, what's going to happen? And there's a fear around that, right? And one of the things I told my class is that I said, obviously, these news media outlets have not been to, like, a Native American graduation at IAIA, which happens every year. That is probably the largest multi-tribal gathering, one of them, you know, or gathering of nations or any, like, big powwow or even the Imagine Native Film Festival. I mean, like, I was making jokes, but I was just like, you know, natives gather all the time in large quantities. They just aren't watching us. So I actually really resist the request to frame an analysis on either geographical or tribal basis, because I don't see that happening in practice that much. I mean, I'm a traditional person in my community of Apache, Oklahoma, and I'm a participant in our ceremony, and that's something that I typically don't theorize. So I've chosen to theorize in an area that I feel comfortable in talking about publicly, and that's, you know, contemporary Native arts world, which is largely you know, multi-tribal and international. And it was less about me working from the product and more about me just working with the person. I recently sat on a review committee with a fellow Indigenous arts scholar person, and this scholar said something that really stood out to me, which was, for me, the object comes first, is how she positioned herself. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I never do that. It's, for me, kind of I make a long-term commitment to a person, and I'm interested in them as a philosopher, theorist, intellectual. And whatever they produce, I'm happy to dive into and swim around in and think about. So,
So Nancy, when you were talking about parameters and framing your argument in the sound essay, can you kind of talk a little bit about what your argument is in this? And I guess not just the essay, but if you lecture on it, I assume that it's like a whole project on sound. So is there a defining argument that you use that you kind of frame all of your thoughts around, or is it
Yeah, so for me, I'm always looking for a way to share what I think of as like the brilliance and creativity of Indigenous communities, and particularly Indigenous communities in the arts, and try to find a way that I can share with others how those productions are so rich in terms of knowledge base, that it's not just an exercise of engaging with an object or engaging with a film, but that those productions are actively creating culture and reproducing culture and creating senses of community. And that's what I find most exciting about just the work that I do in the field. And so for me, I started out looking at physical objects because I went to a tribal college in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And, you know, this was, of course, initially a BIA school that then grew into a self-determination school. And I worked in the collections. And I became, I think, quickly kind of a little frustrated about all the studies that I saw around American Indian art as being descriptive and celebratory and geographically based, because I knew that none of that mirrored the vitality that I saw existing around that object. And so I started looking for ways that I could talk about art that wasn't object-based. Mm. And so I remember like one of my first forays into this was I was asked to serve as a judge for the Miss Indian World pageant in Albuquerque. And there we saw, you know, dozens of women, young women who were participating in something that I think academia would probably disparage, which is, you know, a princess pageant on the surface. But in reality, these young women had to be knowledgeable about their language and their community and their value systems, and even had to match kind of a mandate that reminded me of the coming of age ceremonies for young women in various communities. And as we talked to them, I saw like, wow, they're just so amazing. They're like the representative of so much knowledge and so many hopes and so many prayers, you know. And I realized that they themselves, of course, were not an object. They're a human being, but we were kind of judging them. And it reminded me a little of Santa Fe Indian Market, you know, where they have these categories of objects and they actually get blue ribbons and prizes. And it's a very, I think, dated methodology that we all engage in without really thinking about it. But when I started thinking about those young women, I was like, wow, they are... As people within the culture would say, they're beautiful because they're brown and they're round and they're like amazing. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is empowering. This is really something instructive for me. And I started thinking about, what if we just took those qualities which we're judging these young women on in this setting of Miss Indian World, which was, you know, knowledge of culture, their ability to be able to be a representative of their community. You know, we were basically using criteria that I thought were more representative of community norms than what would be enacted in an assessment of an object. You know, like it would be technique or skill or, you know, shape or size or novelty or whatever they do in those settings. And so for silence, for me, is just kind of a useful window into trying to understand an intellectual system that is in a creative practice more generally. And I came at it through just a really small thing. I think it was a Nora Naranjo Moore's film that was describing the storytelling of her Gia, of her mother, and that when the children would come to listen, she would wait for a moment because she knew that that waiting and that silence resulted in attentiveness, mm-hmm. and that was a useful tool of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And it was just that little small aside in her film that made me start thinking, where else do we find silence? And could this be something like that Indian beauty pageant, right, that sort of allows us to go into a world and to understand it more fully?
Yeah, absolutely. Candace, with the hula practice, just a couple things that Nancy said kind of stood out to me, and I was wondering what you thought about it. If I'm understanding that Nancy's talking about Native American art and film as sort of performance, when you are doing and work with hula So are there moments in the hula performance itself where there's like almost a pause of sound, an intentional pause where you're waiting? It's like a pause for attentiveness. Are there moments like that that are intentional in the hula?
Yeah, I think there is. And maybe I'll first start by saying that my mom is a kumu hula. And so kumu means a source of knowledge, and hula is our traditional dance or a dance form in Hawaii. And so as I'm, you know, speaking or having this conversation, I only speak from my experience as someone who's practiced hula with my mom as a kumu hula, but also other kumu hula that I've danced with or have practiced under. And so this is sort of my experience and understanding as a hula dancer. I think there's definitely moments of silence, as Nancy has put it, and maybe to create some kind of attention, or maybe pausing from between verses, I should say, or maybe different parts of a hula. So maybe an entrance to a hula, and then building up to the mele, which is our song, maybe the main dance, and then the exit hula. And maybe these are found in competition settings, like hula competitions. So such as the Mara Monarch Festival, which is held annually on the Big Island of in Hawaii. So I think there's moments of silence in that way. But I guess for hula, the most important or the critical foundation of hula itself is the language. So without Olelo Hawaii or without Hawaiian language, hula cannot exist. And so this is very different from other forms of dance, you know, found throughout the world. But for hula to exist, the language needs to be present. So if you're dancing hula motions without language, you're just dancing. You're not dancing hula. And so for some people who are not familiar with hula or don't know language, sometimes that can be very difficult to understand. So I think for us, sound is really important in hula. And that sound in particular is language, and language is the foundation of hula.
The reason I asked that question at that time is kind of to make connections between these two thoughts of silence as an intellectual system, and so and hula as an intellectual system, and then as Nancy was saying, these kind of maybe the silence and these sounds are more cultural norms than they are something that's kind of like planned and predetermined as part of a production process. Mm-hmm. But with the hula, going back to that, is there ways then? And so, so hula is very involved with tourism, right? Is there ways that there's a particular way of dancing the hula for a performance, say for like a hotel performance, than there is other ways?
Maybe I should give a little bit of history with hula itself, or maybe Hawaiian culture.
So
when missionaries arrived to Hawaii, which in 1820s around there, you know, Hawaii or Hawaiian language was the language of communication. So when missionaries arrived, they didn't understand that the importance of hula and the importance of hula to Hawaiian culture. So they considered hula a promotion of heathen practices or heathen beliefs. Later on in the century, Hawaiian language was banned in 1896 from being used in educational settings. So although hula wasn't practiced in public domains, it was still practiced privately. And this is how language survived. So language survived through hula. And through these mele, which are our songs or chants, that actually documented our histories, our genealogies, different places, landmarks, information, cultural information about Hawaii. So with the Hawaiian language movement in the 70s or 80s, you know, many of us who hadn't had the opportunity to learn or to acquire Hawaiian as our first language, we learned Hawaiian through hula. And so I guess the question that you have, Marcella, is there a difference between hula being practiced or danced in a at a hotel setting, say at a luau, as opposed to maybe staying in the backyard of a family's home? I think there could be differences. I think we've come to a point, hopefully, where people who practice hula are understanding not only the hula itself, the dance, the gestures and movements, but they're understanding the language. And I think because of the revitalization movement, hula practitioners are also turning to study Hawaiian language. So they have a deeper understanding of what they're dancing. You know, kumuhula or the hula masters or hula instructors and teachers, they teach the hula itself and some of the meaning, but it's also the responsibility of the dancers themselves to educate themselves about the song or the composer, the history, the meaning of the dance that they're performing. So if you go to a luau in Waikiki or other resorts in Hawaii, you can come across a performance, and some of these performances are introduced in a way where they tell you what the song is about, they give you a brief introduction, and maybe even a narration through the song. So I think it depends. Some performances provide another level of understanding so that the audience isn't just guessing to what the motions are representing or represented. So I think it varies on multiple levels. Now, this is just my personal opinion, but there could be others as well if you ask other kumuhula or other hula practitioners. So I think we're at a point where people who practice and maybe who are employed as professional dancers hopefully have that responsibility to educate others about hula, because we don't want the general audience to perpetuate or to tell other people about hula in sort of a different or inauthentic light. And we want to make sure that what is talked about or what is portrayed in hula is what we have known to be hula and sort of the hula culture and tradition. But of course, you know, with media, you know, at the turn of the century, hula was, as you mentioned, sort of, I'm trying to look for the word, hula, when visitors came to Hawaii, they saw hula in a very different light. So we had, you know, cellophane skirts, and hula was more of a contemporary hula, maybe we call them hapahauli songs, which is majority of the song is in English with a few Hawaiian words. And for the audience or the people watching hula, they could understand the hula because the hula was in English. The words or the song itself was written in English, so they could understand the song better. And so when we see maybe early films about Hawaii or that have taken place in Hawaii, they portray hula in sort of that era where maybe there's grass skirts and these movements that are very sort of exaggerated and kind of reminds me of the ocean motion. And everyone just assumes that, oh, that's how you dance hula. And you see these perpetuated over and over in Hollywood films. And every time I see these, I'm like, oh my gosh, here's another one of those films that are portraying hula in, you know, in this light. They should also portray hula in, or not portray hula in that way, but really understand hula as a cultural and traditional art that has survived centuries of, you know, colonization, but also has survived in a way where we're able to revitalize our language. And we have different forms of hula as well. We have the traditional we have actually many forms, but the most common that we've talked about now is hula kahiko, which is the traditional dancing, and then hula awana, which more people are more familiar with, the contemporary hula, contemporary dance.
When you were talking about hula being banned, is that right? It was outlawed?
I guess you can say it was banned, mm-hmm. just like the Hawaiian language, although that's, you know, Hawaiian, we have an exact date when that happened. So as a look down upon, I mean, you can find books that talk about hula as a heathen practice. But it was something that was practiced in private domains. So whether it was at home, they did it privately, you know, to sustain the culture.
Right.
And I think this has happened all over with, you know, colonization of indigenous peoples.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I was thinking, Nancy, what do you think in histories like that? Something that strikes me about your work on silence as being a representational strategy in Native American film. What does that mean if you put it in a historical context to a community of people who have been silenced in so many ways through histories of colonization? Is there a connection to that, do you think? Or is it just the kind of communities and the spaces that we come from are quiet? Or does it have something to do with being silenced and having things taken away from us, having literally language and words and sounds being denied?
Yeah, first of all, Candace, thanks as well for explaining hula. I really gained a lot from that, and I was thinking about parallels with the work that I'm doing with film and silence, and it struck me that the enactment of dance that's dependent upon language, and language being basically kind of the holding place for cultural knowledge, that there's a type of a encoding, maybe, I don't know if that's correct, but, you know, almost like a hidden reference that are encased in this total performative act of dance and language and music and maybe song and action and call and response all together, you know, that becomes a holding space for knowledge. Maybe I'm reading it wrong. I'm open to you correcting me, but you know, that becomes sort of a, I don't know, like a safe space, right? For, mm-hmm. for people to learn knowledge, for knowledge to be passed from one generation to another. And yet that safe space is being enacted in a very public arena. And it reminds me of other cultures such as my own. So, for example, the girls' coming-of-age ceremony is typically enacted in the summer during July 4th. And that was because it was prohibited. And, you know, government authorities would allow things to happen on the birthday of America. When really what was going on was, you know, naming ceremonies, coming of age ceremonies, you know, healing ceremonies, they're all happening under this guise of we're celebrating America. And that's true for, I think, many tribes. So I immediately sort of think about this idea of how do you encase cultural knowledge in a platform that's non-material, that is easily accessible for community insiders, and that functions as a holistic system. And it strikes me that hula might be one of those instances. If I was to move over and try to translate that then into what's happening in current creative endeavors such as film, my curiosity about film and silence is how is silence seen? And of course, you can start with the preconception, the conventional narrative of the silent native, the stoic native, and that's sort of a surface level appraisal. And so then where I'd like to bring that is to say, well, what is silence enacting? Is it a refusal? And I'm really beholden to the scholarship of Audra Simpson, who talks about ethnographic refusal in her Mohawk community. Is it a refusal in that sense to participate? Is it a refusal to give up cultural knowledge? Is it a withholding? Or is silence a generative force? meaning does silence actually create different forms of knowledge? Is it essential to that knowledge creation and generation and sharing? And I think that it depends actually upon kind of specific examples to be able to make that call. And really that's a spectrum of the use of silence. It's not sort of the objectified, well, Native people are always quiet, because we know Native people are usually loud and funny in their own settings and in their own spaces. But, you know, how do we use silence as a tool? And I think a silence can be used as a tool in both of those fashions. And in the one sense of we're not going to give you everything that you're asking for. You could take the Dakota Access Pipeline as an example. You know, last Friday, the tribe, Standing Rock Sioux tribe's lawyers presented in court information about a sacred burial ground that should be protected under the National Historic Preservation Act. On Saturday morning, the corporation that's responsible for building that pipeline brought bulldozers in 20 miles away from the active site of construction, and they actively destroyed that burial. And they created a really tragic, tumultuous, violent scene that was then captured on tape and reproduced all over the world of angry Indians. Okay, so natives at the peace camp, my understanding from what I read in the news feeds is that they were going out to commemoratively mark this sacred space with tribal flags. They were surprised to see the bulldozers, and this confrontation was enacted in which dogs were used as attack dogs against peaceful protectors of that sacred site. I mean, that's a perfect example of what happens when we share cultural knowledge. You know, we were working within the U.S. justice system, the tribal lawyers. I want to say it's Rebecca Sosi was the one that I saw on Democracy Now! Who explained the case that was going before several different courts and judges. Now it's become very complicated. But basically, we were given the opportunity to protect lands and sacred knowledge in the U.S. court system. We complied, and the result was the destruction, complete destruction of that sacred site. So there are contemporary reasons, there are ongoing reasons why cultural knowledge has to be encoded, right? Mm-hmm. And this is something we knew from NAGPRA from day one of, you know, if you give knowledge that's explicit in a Western system, that knowledge will often be exploited and not at the best interest of the communities and the tribes. So, you know, given that long history since contact of exploitation and violence, then what cultural tools are developed? And I really do think that our creative arts are that frame that are being employed now and have been employed for us to be able to think and talk with ourselves about sacred space, about cultural knowledge of how to be in the world, you know, about our relationship to the earth. Every piece of knowledge that we have is typically, I think, embedded within a cultural system that people today from an outside framework would describe as like the creative expressive arts. Mm-hmm. So for me, I was thinking about the concept of silence as it's related to paying attention.
Yeah.
Because that's more on the generative side rather than being silenced or using silence as refusal, which is really kind of you're already reacting to a colonialist mindset with those kinds of premises. Those are reactionary kinds of models. So, you know, I'm always looking for what would exist outside of that colonial frame. And I've got this great quote here by filmmaker and theorist Loretta Todd, who talks about silence in Indigenous film as a form of attentiveness. And she says, "All cultures have their methods of teaching their people. I've noticed that our old people try to get us to be attentive to one another, attentive to the world around us. Let's say that being attentive is in contrast to a culture of noise. And let's say attentiveness reflects a principle connected to how Aboriginal people come to knowledge. The noise of media landscape then would make it difficult to be attentive to the experience and knowledge to be garnered." So, you know, she makes it clear that she's not talking about, you know, silent films or You know, she's not talking about sync sound, but she's talking about attentiveness as being a way of paying close and careful analysis that would include any part of film, including light, shadow, and editing. And she asks, and I think this is really key, how does documentary look when it is no longer based on the binaries of adversaries or intrepid visiting the subject or the science of shedding light on animal behavior? So, I mean, she's using this attentiveness as a way, I think, to talk about how knowledge is garnered, but also how knowledge can be protected and how knowledge can be safeguarded, right, for the future. And so when I use the work of Shelley Nero, which, you know, we didn't go into in any depth in this conversation, but she often uses no dialogue, and she'll use music instead. And I think that that's a kind of a conscious choice for her, because you pay attention in different ways when you're not being guided by, like, the voice of God over you, telling you what to look at, what to see, what to pay attention to. You know, it opens up a new space for the viewer to be able to engage with the material. So I think there's several different avenues in and out of this strategy of silence, and there's several different ways to interpret it. But I think as a generative space to try to begin to understand how Indigenous knowledge works in cultural production, that it's a good frame for us to really just pay more attention to.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the use, just kind of bouncing off what you just said, the use of silence in that way, as you just explained, to me is also a resistance. And it's a resistance to Western filmmaking and to success sometimes for a lot of things, like blockbuster movies or documentaries that are very successful. And if you look at a lot of Native films, people don't respond to them in the same way. And that's because, you know, we're used to that Western idea of film, the Western idea of being entertained, and that we don't really have to think, that we just kind of get to sit there and get, you know, get told what emotions to feel and when.
It's very passive. Really passive. And so if you look at Native creative processes as being generative, and they actually demand something of you. Mm-hmm. the consumption model, I know people kind of just think that you're consuming, whether it's the hula dance or whether it's objects at the Santa Fe Indian Market, you're just consuming. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're truly engaging in that creative practice, you are a participant, and certain things are required of you. And I think that there is a total resistance in terms of audience to be able to do that. You know, even critiques by mainstream press for contemporary Native arts, those reviewers don't want to do the work, you know, to actually go in and understand what's going on a deeper level. And they're not willing to make that commitment. Mm-hmm. And so I think that a Native Indigenous aesthetic framework actually does make demands, where it says, if you truly want to enter into this space, because we have to safely guard this space, you got to do some work, you know. and that itself is should be a standard of higher education. Maybe it will be, but right now we're still in that spectator kind of objective sort of frame of mind.
Yeah, I think I wanted to add one thing. What you said, Nancy, about, you know, the holding space of knowledge, I think how you describe that is very much true of hula, and how hula or culture or language is being enacted in that space. And I think you're right about, you know, as spectators watching hula or the audience that's watching hula at that time, because not many people, or maybe there's a growing number of people that understand Hawaiian language, but majority of people who maybe who do go to these luau's to watch hula, they don't have an understanding of Hawaiian language. So their understanding will be through the motions or through someone's narrative or the introduction of this, of the hula itself. And so in the audience, at any particular moment, there's varying levels of understanding. So maybe there's a local person that, you know, grew up in Hawaii and maybe have danced hula, and then maybe you have another person that has taken Hawaiian language classes, so they have a, maybe a deeper understanding. And then maybe you have someone who's been practicing hula and Hawaiian language is their first language. And then you have the next person who's a tourist from, you know, the mainland. So you have this varying understandings of hula in one place at one time. But I think because of, again, the Hawaiian language revitalization movement, there are many more people, again, who understand Hawaiian language. And so I think how you said it, Nancy, is very a very nice way of summing up, you know, this is, hula is really a holding space of knowledge, and it excludes some people because their lack of knowledge of Hawaiian language or limited understanding of the language, but it also sometimes makes or inspires students to study Hawaiian language because they want to be closer to, say, our culture, to understand the intimate meanings of the language, not just the surface level, you know, the translation that maybe composers provide us, but a deeper understanding and connection to our culture and even to those that have come before us.
Mm. Yeah, it strikes me like what a flexible and adept mechanism, right, that the whole dance complex offers, and how probably most viewers would come to it thinking, this is universally understood. This is universally ours. We can enter into it and have ownership, or, you know, at least go into it as a participant, not kind of realizing that there's several levels to understanding there mm-hmm. that exist, and they may only be interacting on one level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Candace Gala and Nancy Myslow, I think that this is a really good closing thought to leave on. Not to close the conversation or to end it, of course, but to keep it open and return back to it from these reference points. From this conversation and the knowledge that you both bring, I think that your work and this conversation is really working towards engaging with silence as a tool. Engaging with cultural performance as a tool, cultural knowledge as a tool, and really thinking critically about indigeneity through sound. With sound as a framework, I feel like this conversation actively engages in and also asks the audience to actively engage in thinking about Native creative practices as important intellectual systems, right? And to see such performances like hula, for example, that you talk about, Candace, and like the use of sound or silence in creative practices like film, as you shared, Nancy, but to look at these as intellectual systems, as critical holding spaces of Indigenous knowledge. And I think that's just really important work, and sound makes a great kind of exciting platform to engage in these intersections. So I just want to thank you both for your time and everything that you have shared. And also thanks to those listening as well. If you're interested in more of their work, there are links posted to this podcast page, which can be found at www.soundstudiesblog.com. So thank you again. My name is Marcella, and I am out of time. Mi gwech. Have a great day.